Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Winona. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Winona.
I got sober on February 8th, 2002 in Phoenix, Arizona. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I know both of their names, and I talk to them regularly. I'm told I should tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'll do my best to do that. I don't ever remember drinking like a lady. I could tell you a lie and tell you that I did, but I drank because I liked the effect, and I drank to get drunk from the first time that I knew that it was doing something to me that made me feel different. I'm sure that I tasted alcohol like before this first little story that I'll tell you about getting too drunk. I'll say it this way. My parents had a great big New Year's Eve party every New Year's Eve. A lot of people would come. I mean, like 70 or 80 people would come. And I had two brothers and a little sister. I'm the third one. And I grew up in New England in a small town on top of a hill. And all the people that were at the party would have their drinks on the table like your coffee cups now. And my little friend and I, we were about six, I think. We got a big cup and we went around, and if there was anything in any of the cups, we put it all into one big cup. And then we went into my dad's den and we hid under this little table and we drank it to see what would happen to us. Like, that's my earliest memory of alcohol, like knowing or believing that I knew that it would do something to me. Like, why else would we be doing that? And why would we be hiding? You know, that's my earliest memory of alcohol. When I was 12, I guess I should back up a little bit. My parents were not alcoholic. My siblings, to the best of my knowledge, are not alcoholic. I was the alcoholic, but I didn't know it, and I didn't know I knew anybody else that was alcoholic, although I probably knew a lot of people who were alcoholic. I just didn't know that language, and I never really thought I had ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for myself. Like, I don't remember ever knowing anything about it. When I was 12, my brother and I snuck into the movie theater, the drive-in, and we looked in my dad's liquor cabinet. My dad was the kind of drinker who had a liquor cabinet, and about every 3 months he'd open it and take like one shot, you know. So we knew where the liquor cabinet was, up on the top shelf, and there was something in there. We didn't really know what it was or what it would do to us, but we knew it would probably do something. So we looked in there and we found a bottle of Seagram 7. Disgusting. And we took that and we looked in the pantry, and all we seemed to be able to find was some Chex cereal, like dry Chex cereal in the box. So we took the Chex cereal and we took the Seagram 7 and we went to sneak into the drive-in. I don't really remember much about the drive-in, but to go to the drive-in, it was about a mile from my house, and we had to cross, we called it a broken dam. It went across a creek. It was concrete, broken concrete. And we went through the woods. So I woke up laying on the broken dam, and I had vomit from my nose on my face. That's what I remember about that night. Seagram 7, if I smell it, it'd probably make me sick, like, still. I think most people, when they do something that makes them sick, they say, that made me sick, I'm never going to do that again. In my case, I said, that made me sick, next time I better do a better job. So shortly after that time, I went with some friends and drank tequila, way too much, like almost a bottle of tequila by myself. And that was probably the first time I had alcohol poisoning, but I didn't know that language at the time. I don't remember much about that night, but I do remember the next morning, because I was in a car and I had thrown up in the car, and then A lot of people were going to my parents' house. That was our, you know, that was our protocol. A lot of people were going to my parents' house. And the next morning, my mother wanted this guy that I had been in his car. She wanted him to go to the donut shop, and he didn't know where the donut shop was because he lived out of town. So she came and told me to take him to the donut shop, and I had to go back in that car that I got sick in the night before. I do remember that because I like felt like I was going to die. We got the donuts. I don't remember much more about that. I'm just trying to suggest to you that I have a pattern of drinking way too much and not behaving responsibly in any way. So I'll go fast forward a little bit. I don't usually talk about other substances when I tell my story. My sponsor never talked to me about other substances and told me to focus on my problem with alcohol, and so I try to do that to the best of my ability. When I was 16, my parents got divorced, and my mom moved away from where we lived in New England, and I went with her. And we went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that was like culture shock.
Oh, yeah.
So I got a job in a restaurant, and it was in Oklahoma, in order to sell liquor, you had to call yourself a club. So it was a restaurant, but they called themselves a club, so it sounded fancier than it actually was, I think, you know. And they would do things. They would do things they probably shouldn't have been doing. And I was a minor. So my boss would come and tell me, he would come and give me a half a gallon of rum and tell me I had to go home at 11 o'clock at night because they were going to stay and party. And he was more worried about getting in trouble with a minor being there than he was with whatever else they were doing. So they would go do what they did, and I'd go home with my half a gallon of rum. And by that time, I had moved out of my mom's house into an apartment by myself, real close to the restaurant, so I could walk to work. And I would take my rum, and I would go home, and I would drink and way too much. When I was 19, I went in the Air Force, partly, this is not the kind of thing I say in the grocery store, but partly the reason I went into the Air Force is because I liked to party. I liked it. And I saw, like, I didn't see any future in liking to party the way that I liked to party. I understood that at some level. I just didn't know what to do about it. So I joined the Air Force when I was 19, and I went to Panama City, Florida, and we would get a keg of beer in Florida at Tyndall Air Force Base. They have a live firing range over the Gulf of Mexico, and so they have a Marine squadron. It's the Air Force, but they had a Marine squadron. And so those of us who were stationed there, we benefited from that because we could go down to the marina, and for $25, we could get a boat and the equipment and an extra 10-gallon tank of gas so that we could go water skiing all day for $25. So you need a pilot, you need a spotter, and a person to ski. So it's less than $10 a piece all day. So we did that a lot. And we'd bring a keg of beer, and we'd set it down on the beach and tell other friends we were going down there, and we would stay down there until we got really drunk and had to do something else. And so when we were still standing up, we would go back, take a shower, and then go to the club on base until we fell down again. So that was, I really feel like they condoned drinking when I was in the Air Force. It was a long time ago, but they definitely condoned it. They didn't condone doing drugs, but they definitely supported drinking. You know, there was, as long as you did your job, as long as you showed up for your job and did your job, you could drink all you wanted. So after I left Panama City, I went to Turkey, to Incirlik, Turkey. And the first person that I recall telling me that I had a drinking problem was my first sergeant. And I laughed. I probably shouldn't have laughed, but I thought it was funny. If he thought I had a problem drinking, I thought, everybody I know drinks like this. Now, what does that say? You know, but I didn't know any other language at the time. I looked for people who liked to drink the way that I did. I didn't get in any trouble that I can recall while I was in Turkey. Then I went to Spain. I went to Torrejón, Spain. And about 3 weeks after I got to Spain, I met my husband in the bar. He was doing shots of tequila with lime and salt, and that was perfect for me. He was cute, you know, like behind that shot glass, right? A couple months after that, my husband and I got married in 1984. And right before we got married, we were stationed with this other person who was about 6 inches shorter than me and had tight curly hair and a pointy nose and glasses. And we said, let's go into town and get drunk. And we did, and we came back. We were going to come back to the base. And I said, I'm too drunk to drive, you drive. And I gave her my keys. And we got close to the base, and she said, I don't have my ID. And I said, that's okay, use mine. And we got pulled over by the security police. I wasn't driving. I wasn't doing anything against the law. I wasn't at work, I wasn't in uniform, I wasn't driving. But they were wondering what was wrong with us, so they sent us to the hospital to take our blood. And there wasn't anything in my blood except for alcohol, so I didn't pay a consequence that I may have otherwise paid. So I'm almost finished with like what it was like. I'm gonna fast forward several years, but my husband and I got out of the Air Force in 1984, and we came back to the States to Phoenix, Arizona, where he was from. And we had 3 children. And I probably took better care of myself when I was pregnant than I ever have in my life, you know? And I succeeded in not drinking while I was pregnant. But as soon as my 3rd child was where I didn't feel like he needed my hand 24/7, which means when he could walk and talk by himself, I started drinking again the way that I had. And I never had a legal consequence. I never got a DUI. I don't know what that's like, but I have been told by a police officer to get out of his town and never come back. Like, I have had consequences. They were just a different kind of consequence. But what happened, in my opinion, for me, is I may not have had like a legal consequence or a physical consequence. I probably did and didn't know it. I had a spiritual consequence. Like, I lost myself and couldn't find me and just didn't know how to get me back. Like, where was I? I didn't know how to do that. I didn't even know how to say what I just said. And it, like, AA helped teach me how to say that. So my husband and I, but we built a house in Phoenix, Arizona, and the day that we went to sign the papers, I had such a hangover. I can't drink, I couldn't drink, I don't drink brown liquor because it makes me sick. It makes me vomit. And I had drank brown liquor because it was the only thing that was available to drink. And I had a terrible hangover. And we had to go to the title company to sign the papers for our house. And right after we signed the papers, we went to the DMV to get our new driver's license with our new address. And I hated having that driver's license because every time I looked at my picture, it reminded me how sick I felt. But I kept it to remind me, like, you know, maybe someday I can do something about this. So that was 7 years before I quit drinking. Like, I knew something was wrong. I knew something was wrong. I could tell you a lot more stories. I'm just going to tell you a couple more, and then I'm going to tell you what happened. So I drank every day. I was a blackout drinker, and we lived in a master planned community. And I'll tell you two little quick things. I had a job as a circulation manager for a newspaper, and when the driver didn't deliver the paper, if somebody called the paper and said, we didn't get our paper, part of my job was to bring them one and say, yes, you did, we'll take good care of you. And so I was making a delivery on this day, and I was driving outside of Phoenix, probably about 25 or 30 miles, where they had signs that said, trespassers will be shot. And we didn't have cell phones at the time. And I had a bottle of Southern Comfort, the only brown liquor I could drink that didn't make me sick. And I don't really consider Southern Comfort brown liquor, but anyway, I had a bottle of Southern Comfort. I was in a minivan, and I had the Southern Comfort right there. And all I had to do was drive up to this house and take my paper, put it on the, ring the doorbell, you know, and give it to them, and I could go. So I pulled up in front of this house, out in the desert, put my car in park, did not pull over. I was parked in the middle of the road. Put my car in park, picked up the paper, jumped out of the car, and went, oh shit. Because I could see the bottle of Southern Comfort, and I had locked my keys in the car with it, still running, parked in the middle of the road. So I don't know what you would have done, but in my brilliant thinking, I picked up a river rock and tried to break my driver's side window. I hit it really hard. It didn't break. And I thought, I'm going to have to hit it harder. So I hit it again, and this time it did break, and it severed this tendon, and I went like this. But when I went like this, it went like this. So I went, that doesn't look good. It didn't hurt because there's no nerve there, but it looked really bad to me. So I didn't have a phone. I drove myself to the nearest emergency medical facility. It was about 12 or 13 miles away. And before I went inside to ask for help, I brushed, in my brilliant thinking, I brushed all the glass away so nobody would know what happened to my window. Like, gee, where's your window? I don't know. Anyway, so I went to the emergency medical facility and they told me that they could fix my hand right there if I wanted them to, as outpatient, or I could go to the hospital. And I didn't know that. I knew I hurt it bad, but I didn't know that they could fix it that easily. And so I said, you can fix it in your office? And they said, oh, sure, we'll just give you a local anesthetic. And I said, okay, as long as you have somebody who can talk to me while you do that, so I don't have to look at it and see what you're doing, then I can probably do it. And so they fixed my hand. No consequence, no, I mean, there was a consequence, you know, but as you can see, I can, you know, I didn't have a physical consequence and I didn't have a legal consequence. And, you know, like bad things happened, but they just rolled over. You know what I mean? So right before I stopped drinking, one thing that happened, my son was 11 years old when I quit drinking. He took my face in his hands like this and he said, Mommy, please don't drink today. I didn't quit that day, but I had it somewhere lodged, you know. I would drink until I ran out and then I would go get more. That was my pattern. And I was self-conscious about going to the same place all the time. So the nearest intersection to our house where they had like places you could buy liquor, there was an opportunity to buy liquor on every corner at that intersection. And I would just rotate, you know, like so that they didn't know how much I was drinking. Like, I don't know, I wasn't thinking, so. So I left my house one night because I had run out of liquor and I wanted to go get more. And I went to get more and I came back home. This time I did have a phone in my hand. And this was the night before I stopped drinking. I lived in a master plan community and I thought I went to my house, but I didn't, because every fifth house was like the last fifth house. And I got out of my car and I tried to go in the house and they wouldn't let me in. And I didn't know why they wouldn't let me in, so I tried harder. And they didn't like that I was doing that, so they called the police. And the police came and I had a phone in my hand and I wasn't in my car. And I lived in that neighborhood. I didn't have a consequence. I probably should have, but I didn't. So they took my phone and they called my husband and said, can you please come get your wife? And he did, and I went home. So the next morning, my husband said to me, last night you got really drunk and you went to the wrong house and I came and picked you up and I brought you home. And I said, thank you. So then I went downstairs and my daughter, who was 15 years old, said, do you know what you did last night? And I said, yes, because my husband had just told me. She said, I wish you had gotten arrested. Then maybe you would do something about your problem. I still have no memory of that other than what my husband told me. So the story I just told you is what he told me, because I don't remember. So the next day I called a friend of mine who's a social worker. I forgot to tell you that from the time I was 12 years old, I wanted to be a social worker. I called my friend who was a social worker, who worked for Terros. It's a rehab facility, was well known in the Southwest. She was pretty high up the chain. And I asked her if she could help me. And I knew her like through church, like not from drinking, you know. And she said, I think I know somebody who can help you. And so this is what happened for me. She called me back after I made that first phone call to her and asked me if I was willing to go see a doctor. And I said yes. And she told me the name of the doctor to go see and the number. And so I went to see him. And he said, I think I can help you, but the first thing I want you to do is go to a charter hospital for detox to make sure that you don't hurt yourself by stopping drinking abruptly. And I said, okay. And so I did that. I went on Saturday, and I got out on Monday. I worked in the elementary school. I missed one day of work. I didn't get in any trouble there, then, at that time. I got out of detox, and when I got out, I went back to his office, and he asked me if I would go to AA, and I said I would. Actually, what he said to me is, "Will you do anything that you're asked?" And I said, "As long as it doesn't hurt me." And that wasn't the answer he wanted, and so he asked me again, "Will you do whatever you are asked?" And I thought he wanted me to say yes, so I said yes, I'll do whatever I am asked, because I really wanted help at this point. I've left out a lot. Let me back up just a couple of steps. When I was in detox, there was a woman who was probably about the age that I am now. She was tall and she had white hair. And she gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she opened it up and she said, here, read this, and gave it to me. And I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous or the big book yet until that time. That was my introduction. And I so wanted her to know that I intended to do what I was asked. So instead of going back to my room to read it, I got a chair from the little like rec room area, and I put it right next to the lobby desk or whatever where she was sitting, so she could see that I was reading it, that I was doing what she asked me to do. Because at that time, I remember that that seemed important to me, to try to be sincere, even in my brokenness. So I went back to the doctor, and he told me to go to an AA meeting, and I said I would, and then I have to back up another two steps. While I was in detox, they brought an AA meeting in, and that lady who gave me the book told me that I couldn't go home until I heard the medical words of wisdom on alcoholism, okay? And I said, okay. And then she said, there's going to be an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in there in just a few minutes, and you should go in there. So I went into that room, and there were, you know, some people, and there were two people who had come from outside, a man and a woman, to bring the meeting in. And I was not feeling very good, and I'm usually pretty social, I think that I am, but I wasn't that day. I had my head down, I had a cup of coffee, there was a jigsaw puzzle on a table in the back of the room, sorry. And so I went and I sat down at that table away from everybody else, and I looked down so I could do the puzzle and not have to engage. And I heard this woman say, happy, joyous, and free. And I looked up because I wanted to know who was talking about being happy, joyous, and free in this kind of arrangement, you know? While she was talking, the gentleman came over and sat down next to me and said, if you're willing to write your name and your phone number on a piece of paper, I will give it to a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous and she will call you. And I said, okay. It was brand new to me. And I said I would do what I was asked. So I did. I wrote my name down on a piece of paper and I gave it to him. This was on February, I think like 10th or 11th. And it was Valentine's Day, so just a couple nights later, this woman called me and started taking me to AA meetings, and I'm going to kind of fast forward a little bit. She became my sponsor. I didn't find her. She found me, literally. Like, you know, she literally called me first and didn't know who I was. And that made an impression on me, too. Like, she really reached out the hand of AA for help, you know, to someone who was in need. So that's what happened. Like, I told you what it was like, and I told you what happened, how I got here, but now I want to tell you what it's like now, because they told me that I would be amazed before I was halfway through, and I have to tell you, I am amazed, and I hope I'm not halfway through. So, I don't know how I'm doing here.
You're good. You're 8:35. You got plenty of time.
Okay, thank you.
Good.
Okay, so I'm going to try to tell you what it's like now by telling you a little bit about how I understand the steps, okay? Step one tells me that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable. I knew that before I got here. I did. I might not have known how to say it in the words that I just said it, but I knew that I had a problem with alcohol, and I knew that it had beaten me. I knew that. I learned by going to meetings that I had a hole in my soul, and you knew it. Like, there was something a little bit sad about that and a little bit miraculous both at the same time. So step two is about coming to believe in a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. Now, I thought I believed in a power greater than myself, and I had no problem calling that whatever that is, that higher power. I had no problem calling that higher power God. But see, I tricked myself. I thought when I wasn't behaving myself, it was okay because God had my back. And that way I could blame God for my problems. And you know, like, that's shameful to me. To be that way. I was that way, and maybe sometimes I still am that way sometimes, but hopefully not nearly as much as I was, I hope. The part of step two that was hard for me was not coming to believe that. The part that was hard for me is to acknowledge the part that I could be restored to sanity, because in order for me to do that, I would have to acknowledge that maybe I was not sane. And I resisted that. I took offense to that. Like, don't you know? So I had to re-examine some of my behaviors, like waking up on the broken dam with vomit on my nose and breaking my driver's side window with a river rock. You know, those behaviors are not what I would say like a person with good rational thinking would do. I don't think. So I'm just suggesting that I had some behaviors, you know, going to the wrong house and thinking that it was my house because I was too drunk to know the difference. Those behaviors, if I measure those behaviors as being somewhat insane, alcohol induced, but nonetheless insane, then I could come to terms with step two, that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity with help. I could come to that. And I love that in AA we say that. I came to believe. Like, that, it, like, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. But I believe that. I like that I believe that. It helps me. That hole in my soul started to get smaller. And I liked it. So step three is, willing to give my life over to the God of my understanding. I am willing to do that to the best of my ability, except for when I'm not. So I just say that because as willing as I want to be, as good as I might say to you that I think I am, as hard as I try to do the right thing, I don't want to tell you about the times when I don't do the right thing or when I'm not willing to give my life over to the care of God in all of my affairs, especially if I'm mad at you or you. I don't want to do that. But I say it out loud to hold myself accountable because I want to be more that way. And one of the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous is it says that it's about progress, not perfection. So I don't have to beat myself up trying to be perfect or trying to be something that I never will be. That's the permission. I love that. It's about progress, not perfection. I don't have to beat myself up about it because I am going to try my best. But you know what? Quite frankly, some days my best, you know, it's not top notch. Sometimes my best is like more, you know, down here a little bit. I'm just trying to be honest. But I like to think I have more better days than I do bad days. I'm just trying to be honest about the balance. And I have to tell you, you know, well, let me tell you step four first, and then I'll tell you. Step four is about doing a complete and thorough inventory, moral inventory, and writing it down so that I can share it in my fifth step with my sponsor or somebody that I trust and feel safe with. And what I feel like I learned when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is that everybody's afraid of the fourth step. And I changed my mind about that. Like, because I puzzled over it for a long time. Why is everybody so afraid of the fourth step? They're not, in my opinion. They're afraid of telling somebody. So the thing is about a fourth step, no matter what I have done, all the naughty, bad, icky, sticky, maybe smelly things that I have done, I've already done them. They can't get me unless I open that part of me up and bring it back in to beat myself up. I've already done them. And I'm trying not to do them again. I'm trying not to have repeat really poor behavior. So when I do the four step to the best of my ability, I get more honest with myself about what my part is in my peoples and places and things that I have problems with. If I look at my part, one of the things that I'm sure I heard more than once in meetings is when I'm pointing a finger at you, I'm pointing three back at me. You know, like I'm judging you, well, I'm also judging me, you know. And step four helped me with that, to be, excuse me, as it says in How It Works, to be rigorously honest. So I understood my sponsor in Arizona to tell me when I did my fourth step to write down everything that ever hurt me. That's what I heard her say. I don't know if she really said that, but in my head, that's what I remember her saying. So I took it to task. I wrote down everything that I thought hurt me that had to do with people, places, or things. And that's how I did my fourth step with my sponsor, by going through that directory, if you will. And then, well, when I did my fifth step, I can't tell you that I felt like I had an epiphany when I did it. I don't really feel like I did. I know some people have told me they did, and I encourage them, do it, because you might, and it'd be so cool. It would be awesome. Like, we overuse that word, but in this case, it would be awesome. You know, I do believe I've had an epiphany in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it wasn't just directly associated with finishing my fifth step. It was coming to and coming to believe that there was a solution for me, for my problem, and that I was not alone, and that other people could understand the language that I was being taught and share it with me. That was kind of like the epiphany for me. So, sixth step, they told me that that's the step that separates the men from the boys. Like, am I serious about this or not? You know, and I used to say, well, I'm not a boy, and I'm not a man, you know, and that's me resisting. That's me separating myself out instead of identifying myself in, so I don't have to work harder, or so that I don't have to be more faithful, or so that I don't have to be more honest about my character defects, you know. So step seven is, you know, asking God to humbly remove those character defects. And do I mean it? Can I be humble enough to really mean it? I think I can if I try. But if I don't do anything, nothing happens. And I kind of feel like I learned that in AA. If I don't do anything, nothing happens. You know, so do I really want God to take my character defects? Yes, except for the ones that I'm still holding on to because I like them in the moment. You know, like, wait a minute, wait till I want to be mad at this person a little bit longer. I don't want to give that one up, you know. So I do want to ask God humbly to take all of my character defects with the understanding that it's not really going to happen completely, and that's okay because I'm making progress, not perfection. And that's good enough for me. I'm okay with that. So step 8, writing down all the people that I need to make an amends to. And step 9 is actually making the amends. So step 8, I might miss somebody, but if I'm being really honest with my sponsor, and if I was really honest with my sponsor about my 4th step, by now, by the time I'm doing my 8th step, she's going to be able to call me on my stuff, you know? Like, if I'm really being honest. And if I'm not, that's not on my sponsor, that's on me, you know? Like, do I want this or not? By the time I got to my 8th step, I knew that there was a solution for me. I knew that. And I was so excited. I have to tell you, I was really excited in my first year of sobriety because I believed that it worked for some people. I wasn't fully convinced that it worked for me. I just didn't know that it would work for me. But I did believe that it would work for some of you because I could see the look in some of your eyes. I could see the look that changed in some of your eyes, and I thought that was miraculous, and I wanted that. I definitely wanted that. I still want that. So when I go to make an amends to somebody, it's simply not just saying I'm sorry. An amends, like from the heart, is there anything that I can do to make this right? And my actions are louder than words, you know? So it's a good start on trying to do that. So when I get to step 10, I think of the step 10 as the maintenance step, you know, keeping my side of the street clean. When I go to bed at night, do I look back and see what kind of day I had? And do I need to make things right with anybody that I was not my best self with, you know? Hold myself accountable. I think that's important, to hold myself accountable. So the 11th step is getting conscious contact with a power greater than myself, which I choose to call God. And some of my favorite meetings have been 11th step meetings. I just like the connection. I like having a connection with other people. I like having a connection with the God of my understanding. I like that I didn't drink today. I like that I have a choice today that I did not know that I had. And like a gift from God, like truly, like a gift from God. It was from AA, but you know, AA, God led me to AA, and AA led me to God, and it, like a cycle, but not a sick cycle, you know, like a healthy cycle. So the 12th step is about carrying the message, and that's what I'm trying to do right now, is carry a message to alcoholics who may be still struggling and trying to find a solution for a problem that just took us like a whirlwind and kind of, you know, threw us down in the dirt a few times, you know. Whenever anybody reaches out, I want my hand to be there like somebody's hand was there for me, you know. So that's just my brief 12-step thing. I think I got a couple more minutes here. I want to share a little bit more about like what it's like now to you, because after I'd been sober for 10 years, in that process, sober, 7 years after I quit drinking, my husband quit drinking. And then a year later, we lost our house that we built. And I moved from Arizona to Virginia. And that week that I moved here, my oldest daughter graduated from Tulane. My youngest daughter got married in Illinois, and my son graduated from high school in Phoenix, Arizona. So that week, that's what happened, and I moved here. And my husband wasn't well enough to come with me. He didn't, he stayed in Arizona for a few months. Well, one of the people that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous in Arizona, he's like a brother to me. He'd been sober. I just have to tell you this little part of my introduction to AA. When I went to my first meeting that became my home group, there was a couple people in the meeting who said that there was this guy who was a member of the group, and he was really sick, and he was in the hospital, and he had an infection in the sac around his heart. And he wanted to know if anybody would go to his house and take a meeting to him. And the lady sitting next to me said, "Hey, you want to go to this meeting?" And I said, "Okay." And that's how I met this guy. I went to his house. We had a meeting for him. He got better. He started coming back to the meetings like he always had. He is a professor. He teaches. He's retired now, but he taught teachers at Arizona State University how to teach using technology, right? And so he always would say to me, "I should go back to school," and it intimidated me a lot because when I was in high school, I was so much more interested in partying that I wasn't paying better attention to my grades, and that my teachers always told my parents that I could be a better student if I applied myself, and I just didn't. I just didn't. That's the truth. That's the best way I know how to say that today. So I was very intimidated. So he asked me to go with him one day. He wanted me to go to the university and take a placement test, and I did. And I was very nervous. I didn't want to do it because I thought I would do poorly. And you know, you have to know how to add and subtract, or you probably can't do that. And I was worried that I knew how to add like one-digit numbers, but I had trouble with two-digit numbers. And so he took me, and I scored well enough that they said, "You can sign up for classes if you want to." And I didn't, because I was intimidated, I wasn't very brave. So it was a couple years before I moved here. So I moved here in 2009. And I went to work in elementary school. And I moved here because my mom lived here. And my mom was having hip surgery and she needed help. And I called her up and said, "Do you want me to come stay with you for a while?" And she was like, "Would you really?" And I said, "Yeah, I need help too." And so I came and I worked in the school and thought I should go back to school. So I signed up for classes at Rappahannock Community College. And they had a 2-4 program that if you went there, then you could go to Old Dominion. So I went to Old Dominion, and I graduated in 2012. And then I wanted to go to graduate school, and I had to take a year off because I had had some college courses when I was in the Air Force, and they didn't think I could get the transcripts before the deadline, whatever. And she told me I had to wait for a year, and I said, "Okay, I don't care. I'm going to do whatever you tell me." So I had to wait. I started graduate school in 2014. And my mom wanted me so much to go to school. She wanted me to go to graduate school. And she really wanted me to go. And I started in August at VCU in Richmond. I did a distance learning program. It was a 4-year program. I started school in August, and my mom passed away in November that same year. And I graduated in 2018. With a master's degree in clinical social work. And when I graduated, I wanted to get, you're still not licensed once you graduate. And I needed a lot of hours, like over 1,000 hours. So I called this counseling center in Gloucester where I live that I thought might know some information about that. It was right before I graduated, and she said, "Well, I can't really help you. I'm a professional counselor. I'm not a social worker. But I know this lady who could help you. You should call her." And so I called this lady. I didn't know who she was when I called her, and she answered her phone the first time I called her. I didn't know who she was. She was the CEO of Middle Peninsula Northern Neck Community Services Board. And she wasn't the CEO at the time, 5 years ago when I called her. She was the clinical director of the CSB in Gloucester. And I called her and I told her what I was doing, and she said, well, if you apply for a job at CSB, I can get you those hours. And I said, okay, so I had a job before I graduated. I graduated in 2018, and I took my license for clinical social work in October a year ago, and passed. And I've been at the CSB. I don't usually tell people that. I don't think I've ever said that in a meeting before, that I work there. Now I'm self-conscious. But I've been there for 5 years, and I'm an emergency services counselor, and I love the work that I do, and they let me do it. They let me. I wanted to do that since I was 12, and I just got lost. And then I got found because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you, they told me I would be amazed before I was halfway through. I am amazed. I hope I'm not halfway through. It's I get to try to be my best self. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank God for progress of the profession. And Appendix 2 for me. Mine has certainly been the educational variety. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers rent, supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Inner Council Group. Are there any AA-related announcements? I don't have the details in front of me, but I do know that there is supposedly a very big picnic over in City Park in Portsmouth tomorrow. I believe it is 11 to 2 o'clock. Probably a little late to bring a dish if you wish. However, please do. Ought to be a fun time. Face painting, pony rides, AA songs and skits, from what I hear and gather. It's a pretty big shindig and a pretty big deal. Any other announcements? Yes, ma'am.
I'm Claire, alcoholic.
Hey, Claire.
So there is going to be